Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff.
In this show, we're going to dive deep into flips, wholesales, holding rentals, and creatively structuring deals.
So that we can show you how you can achieve that lifestyle of freedom that you desire.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff. Today, we are honored to have our good friend Zach Mattson here. He's got a couple of companies. He's got Picket Fence Homes. He's got Mattson Homes. He does new builds. He does flips. He's kind of all over the place in terms of what he can do. He's the jack of all trades. We're really excited to pick his brain and dig in. Today, we're going to focus on new construction because that's what he's the most passionate about. But I'm really excited to have Zach on the show. Funny side note, he was actually our first ever guest. So Zach, we appreciate your support. I'm sorry that we filmed that episode in Jeff's living room. We've since improved, where we film these podcasts and stuff like that. But we're excited to have you back in an official studio and give you the podcast that you deserve as well. So yeah, thanks for coming sure. on.
Yeah, man. Thanks. This is great. It sounds a lot better.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it feels a lot better too.
It's a little different than the one mic set up in the living room. Right. I love it, man. Cool. Well, we like to get started with why you got started in real estate and what the beginning of your journey into real estate looked like. So walk us through what got you inspired to make the jump to real estate and then how you got started.
Yeah. So it started a long time before I ever got into real estate. It started when I was 23, just started reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Okay.
And then read a bunch of Robert Kiyosaki's books. Nice. Started going to like those free seminars. Mm-hmm. But at the time I had no money. And then, now it's like, you know, a lot of people can start and wholesale and everything. And I could have done it, but I was, looking for a job. And so I started my career job at the time back then and kind of rose through the ranks with that for like 10 years. And in the meantime, I kept reading, kept studying, getting promoted with my job, which brought me to Boise. And I bought my first duplex in Boise about a year after I moved here. I started going to more seminars once I started having a little bit more time with my job. When I first moved here, it was it was turning a store around, so it was like just very intensive of my energy. But after a couple of years, I kind of got the ship turned around, and so I had some extra time and money to kind of start investing in real estate. So I started my LLC back in 2014.
Okay.
back then, I started trying to buy houses, so I had a couple under contract, and then come to find out they were they just weren't as good of deals as I thought they were.
Gotcha.
I had wrong information. I didn't have the best, the best analyzation skills back then.
Gotcha.
But I never actually, I lost some earnest money, but I never closed on them. And then I got super busy 2015, and then I got fired from my job in the beginning of 2016, and I started flipping.
Nice.
So by that point, I had saved up enough money to kind of start doing it on my own. So that's kind of how I got started into flipping.
Awesome.
So that year, I just bought my first like little two bedroom house on the bench for $70,000.
that's insane.
Killer. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I did pretty much all the work myself besides I hired a roofing contractor, concrete contractor to do the driveway. Mm-hmm. But I did all the plumbing, all the refinished floors, painting, putting in cabinets, all that kind of stuff. So pretty much did most of the work myself. And then from there, from my first one, I was trying to kind of thinking I'd scale up. So I hired a general contractor for my second. That went terribly wrong. It took, something that they agreed to fix up in 2 months. It took them 9 months, I think.
Wow.
And I didn't have the skills or whatever to hold them accountable. So that was, I still made actually good money on it.
Yeah.
It was just a lot longer than I expected.
Yeah.
But then towards the end of that one, I bought another house. And then I actually sold both that one and the next house on the same day they closed. So I was like rolling in the dough at that point.
Yeah. Having your first day of two closings is like a monumental day in real estate. It's so much fun.
I'm freaking rich.
Yeah. Which it's really crazy though, because I was down to my last $10 in any of my accounts
that's
on
awesome.
That day.
That's so
I mean,
wild.
I knew I had the closings coming up, but I was like, okay, I might have to borrow some money.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So that first duplex that you bought when you moved here, did you live in that and then rent out the other side?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So nice. That's if anybody's getting started in real estate, that's still a solid way to go. I mean, you might, so I basically lived there for free. I had to pay utilities. That's about it.
Yeah.
That's hard to do anymore. But if you're still, I mean, if you're paying less than rent is, or, you know, if as long as my deal is, as long as it's going to cash flow a decent amount once you move out,
yeah,
that's a good deal.
Yeah. And so did you, do you still hold on to that duplex or did you sell it?
I sold it. Okay. You know, hindsight, I would almost wish I would have kept that. Yeah. But I had it for like 3 years and I was like, oh, you know, the rents I feel like is kind of capping out and I could have used the cash flow or the cash influx into my business at the time. So I sold it and I made, you know, for the time I had it, I pretty much didn't pay anything. Like my renters were paying my mortgage and I actually cash flowed like $600 for a couple of years.
Yeah.
It's really good, by the way.
Yeah. And then I sold it for like a $95,000 profit or something after 3 years. So
that's
more than any of us have ever made in a W-2 job in a 1 or 2 year period.
Right. Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, that's amazing. Man.
Not to mention I lived there rent free, basically.
Right. So you count your savings in there too.
For a year and a half, I lived there rent free and then, you know, then made cash flow for another year and a half or so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the profit on top of that. So, and then all the tax benefits you have of it too. So,
yep.
Hey, so I kind of want to, I was just thinking about this. There's this lull in real estate where it's like deciding you want to start and then actually doing your first deal. That's a very hard time mentally, deal wise, understanding deals. And you touched on it a little bit, but I actually think that it'd be really cool. Maybe this becomes a segment in the show, where we can attach some type of cool name to it. But like, let's dig into like, Zach deciding he wanted to go into real estate to closing that first deal. Like, I want to hear about the challenges because they're there. And I think a lot of times, like, we forget about it. I mean, that, you know, you're a very successful real estate investor. It's easy to forget about that time frame of 0 to 1, but I'm very curious about it.
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, I'm probably a great example of maybe what you maybe shouldn't necessarily do. Like, I wait a long time. Like, you know, like from the time I read my first book and started going to weekend seminars, it was like 12 years before I bought my first property. So no, I take that back. It was 8 years. But still it was a long time. I mean, there was a couple cities in between. Part of it, you know, was, so I was studying a lot. So I was like gaining a lot of knowledge, which I have no regrets about. But I almost wish I would have started just, you know, when
went
I,
after it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. you know, but I was focused on trying to, you know, make an income, you know? So, I guess I just didn't have the confidence that, you know, I could go out there and use, you know, my no money and find deals and, you know, but I almost wish I would have. So if anybody's, you know, thinking about doing it and there's all these young kids that are like, we'll just go wholesale. That's a great way to start. And, you know, you can make some good money and then, you know, and probably more importantly than making the little bit of money wholesaling compared to some of the bigger deals is, you know, you get into that circle, you know, because that's been one of the biggest things for my business is just being connected in town and like knowing people and getting deals from other people and giving deals to other people and that, you know, that kind of thing. So that's, you know, it's all kind of a mix in that. but yeah, I wait a long time. I read probably 40 books on real estate investing. I probably went to 5 or 6 seminars. Mm-hmm. I spent, you know, $40,000 on those expensive seminars, which I don't regret one bit. I made that back on my very first deal. So that was kind of my deals. I studied a lot, but I probably waited a little bit longer than, you know, looking back, maybe I would have done it differently, but you know, no regrets at the same time. You know, for people that are trying to get into it, I would just jump in whatever you can do, wholesaling, whatever.
And then you got that duplex while you still had your current job, right?
Yep.
So that duplex was probably a key part in making you feel comfortable to make that jump then, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So, that's what I love about the house hacking model, man, is like it's easy for somebody with a W-2 job to get into something like that, right? And now you just eliminated so much stress and risk in your life where like you were living for the cost of utilities only. That meant your mortgage payment was covered, which meant you could go and take a risk that maybe somebody who was in a W-2 job and instead of getting a duplex and house hacking went and bought an $800,000 house because they were making good money and they wanted to live the life, right? Like you made a smart decision that minimized your risk and allowed you to then take more risk in starting a business and starting to flip and do some new builds and stuff like that. So I really like hammering down. I think it's a reoccurring theme. Like so many people that we get on the show all started with a house hack or some sort of investment property that then just relieved the burden from them on the high monthly expenses and allowed them to take that risk. So I think that's really cool, man.
Yeah, I think it's important for people, especially on your, I mean, on your first house or second house, I mean, a lot of people get house poor.
Yeah.
So they buy the house that they, you know, can afford.
Yep.
But then it's like, can you really afford it if you can't afford to actually, you know, long term to improve your life the, right. The way you want it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
What are some of the action steps you took? And it sounded like to me a little bit that real estate really started in terms of like full time for you when your job fired you. And then all of a sudden you're like, well, I've been learning for the last 10 years. I prepared myself for something like this. What are some of the action steps you took to lock up some of those first deals and those flips?
Yeah. So, and to be honest, so 2016, I got fired like January 5th, but like I had an exit plan. I was going to quit at the end of the year.
Nice.
So just, you know, my time frame shortened by 12 months, but that it was great because it kind of lit a fire under my butt because, you know, I was like maybe not super comfortable with the money I had in the bank at the time. I'm like, it would have been more comfortable, but, you know, sometimes uncomfortable.
It's good.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, motivate you.
Yep. So, but yeah, so basically my action steps. So, so I had gone to seminars. In fact, I finished up, I was actually still kind of in the process of going to weekend seminars. So I went to, I think like one or two more, one in Salt Lake City and then another one in Phoenix. And then I started to, just market, drive for dollars. So I basically like, I got some really good information from these seminars on like what works. And so just driving for dollars. So I'd like go, I'd get a list from the title company and I would drive through my neighborhood, and take pictures of houses that didn't look very good. Oh, and by the way, so this works really well for like non-owner occupied, but taking pictures of like owner occupied is, I don't know that I would recommend it, and it's not the same marketing strategy anyway. So non-owner occupied.
Yeah.
And then you send that picture, and then like my sheet of paper I had sent was just super simple. It had a picture of their house and said, "Is this your house?" And on underneath it, I just put, "Looks like something I'd be interested in buying." And a lot of times the rentals, you know, they don't look as nice as like, you know, the owner occupied stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, and a lot of times people about a state or across town, they don't see their property ever.
Yeah.
So when the grass is dead and the weeds are growing and the paint's flaking off or the roof is bad.
They don't know it looks like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that's a lot of times it kind of grabs their attention a little bit.
Yeah.
So I actually had a decent response rate from that. I had out of, you know, every 100 flyers I'd send, I'd probably get, you know, 5 phone calls.
It's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like almost 3x the normal response rate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So that was really successful, and I've done it here and there since then, but it's like I'd never consistently have the time to do it, and I should probably delegate that out at some point. But then it's, you know, anyway, but but yeah, that's how I found my first deal. So it was this literally like 8 blocks from where I live in the same like mile radius.
Yeah,
I found this rental little 2-bedroom house, and you know, you drive by and like it was, you know, weeds in the yard, overgrown. Looks like the trees hadn't been maintained in 20 years.
Yeah.
So I sent the picture to the sellers. There was this really cute little old couple. And so they called me. This is like in the first 2 weeks of marketing, they called me. Yeah. And so we set up a time to go visit the house. And so I went and looked at it. And it's just funny. Like, I'm sure you guys have come across this stuff. But like, so we get there and I open up the front door and there's literally like stacks of newspaper, 5-foot tall, through the entire house. There's like a 18-inch wide pathway to the bedroom and then that's into awesome. The kitchen. Yep. And like there's one open seat on the couch.
Yeah.
And it just stacks of newspaper everywhere. The second bedroom, like literally couldn't even open the door. It was like floor to ceiling, just junk.
Oh my goodness.
And then same thing, master, like the first bedroom is like junk everywhere, just 2 spots to lay down. So it was just interesting. And then, you know, so the renters there, the wife was actually, she had cancer, which is unfortunate, but also I think that, them getting out of that house is probably good for her cancer because
100%.
Yeah. So when you walk in, you can just smell the pet like urine and then the mustiness. And I have a feeling, and there's this other weird smell with it too. Like, Anyway, so I feel like her getting out of that house. I mean, I don't know. I haven't followed up with the renters, but they actually owned a house across the street. But it was the same thing. I think they filled it up so much that they
can't even
couldn't live there. Yeah. So they were renting this other house.
Oh my god!
So they ended up moving back to their house that they owned. But I feel like it was a good thing, a good change in their life. So
yeah.
But yeah, I bought that house for $70,000. Did all the work myself. I think I spent like $32,000. And this is the one and only time I've ever been under budget. I budgeted $35,000 and I spent $32,000.
Nice. Way to go.
A little sweat equity to save some money.
Yep. So I was in it for, $102,000 and I ended up selling it for $170,000, I think.
Holy smokes, nice, man. So, that was your first one?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Way to almost, it almost jades you on the rest of them, right? Because it's like you go out and do it. So you were in it for $105,000.
Yep.
Sold it for $170,000. You made $65,000. Yeah. And then did you list it yourself?
I think.
I mean, commissions were in your pocket, and then you didn't pay yourself as a contractor, so it's all kind of bundled together. But still, now every deal you looked at after that, was probably, you're like, $35,000. I don't know. I just made $60,000 on this other one.
We ran into this last year where we killed it on a couple little 2-1s that we flipped in like 3 weeks and made like $70,000 per. And we're like, this is awesome. And then now we're looking at like normal deals and they make like $45,000 to $50,000. And Noah's like, I don't know, dude. I'm like, no, this is normal. This is what we should expect. Those ones were just, we'll take them. They're home run hits.
But, right. Yeah. Yeah. When you're trying to analyze every property, like, oh, I need to make $70,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's through that filter.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
So, oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, I was going to say, so you flipped that one and then now you're mostly new construction. So what about it did you not like about flips, or what about it did you love so much about new construction that you decided to switch that up?
So it's kind of a combination of a couple things. One is a lot of failure, and two is a lot of opportunity. So so the failure comes in is where, I'm trying to scale my business, right? From the very beginning, I'm thinking, okay, I need to flip 40 houses a year. That was like my goal. Well, I started using my own money with hard money.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, you do one house and you tie up, you pay 20% down, and then you have 100% construction budget, but you have to buy all the materials or pay contractors. And so you're paying, like I was paying like $10,000 a month out my pocket before I get reimbursed, so, you put your 20% down plus all your closing costs, plus your, your fees. And then you have, $40,000 a month on each house that you have to just have ready. And then you're paying interest payments every month on top of that. So it just takes a lot of cash per house that I didn't anticipate actually up at that point. So it was like, okay, I can do one or two houses at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're doing those one or two houses, I did everything on the first one. And then the second one, I actually hired a general contractor that, kind of messed me up. It took way longer. And it went over budget. And, so I got super frustrated with that. so that was like the first failure with the general contractor. And then the third house, like I went back to doing it on my own. And I hired a guy, and then my fourth one, I hired three guys, and they were actually probably more expensive than just subbing everything out, because they're, it was basically nobody that had any kind of experience. Bless
yeah.
You.
Yep.
So that was like a learning experience for me. Plus then, you have like all the insurance costs, being a contractor then, and like everything else, all the employer costs, that you don't really factor in necessarily. So it was just, so that was like a learning experience. And then I went back to eventually again, like hiring another general contractor on this flipping Jerome, that went horribly wrong.
Oh, no.
So basically it was another thing where it's like, okay, they thought they could fix it in 8 weeks. We ran into an issue where we saw that the part of the house didn't even have a foundation.
Solid. So literally.
Yeah. So. So, I mean, that, those unexpected things come up, and it was like, okay, this will take 3 or 4 weeks to to work around, which is fine. I planned, when we were thinking 2 months, I was like, oh, it's going to take 3 or 4 at least.
Mm-hmm.
But then it took 11 months because it was like, plus it's in Twin Falls. So like I'd go out there once a week, but like the once a week I'm out there, I'd find out that the contractors weren't there at all that week.
Oh man.
And it's like, the contractors told, like, I talked to them 100 times and they'd tell me one thing, and then I'd go out there the next week and it was never done.
Yeah. So different. Yeah.
Yep. So, and when, by the way, so this is a little nugget of information. If you're flipping or doing new builds or whatever, I always sign contracts with your contractors, but not their contract. Yeah. You can sign their contract, but you need your own contracts that holds them liable allows you to get out of the deal if, you know, they're not holding up their end of the bargain.
Yep.
And, you know, basically it's not going to cost you extra money if you're, if you get out of the deal.
Yeah.
So I kind of learned that the hard way. I signed their contract, but I didn't have my own contracts. I had them, but I didn't have them sign it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that,
can we dig a little deeper into why? Cause I think that'd be helpful for people. So why do you want them to sign yours instead of you signing theirs?
Yeah. So basically their contract is protecting the contractor. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of information in there that's like they holding them accountable, but it's like not nearly the level that it needs to be at, because basically they can give you the runaround for weeks and months and whatever, and it's not going to cost them a dime, but it's costing you, you know, hundreds of dollars every week that it, you know, they're not doing something. So your contract is basically protecting you, and it gives you the ability to fire them at any point. And it holds them to a timeline too. So you have, like laid out the whole construction timeline. And if, as soon as you get off that timeline, you can either fire them or you can readjust it, whatever, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's, and the thing is too, if you have those contracts set up with contractors, they know that you mean business and they're going to make you a priority. Whereas if you're just the average customer, they're going to take every other job ahead of you and do that priority because they're making money like crazy. They're just, you know, so you really, it's critical that you set up contracts.
You got to protect yourself in those things. You can add in like late penalties and then like certain things that happen, and I was told if you add a late penalty you also need to add in some sort of bonus, but for being honest, like, no offense to any general contractors listening, like very rarely do they get done earlier than the timeline. It's almost always past. So then you protect yourself. And we've had times where like I'll have a penalty in there and I'll maybe impose it at like 30% as long as they like actually then went and wrapped it up. But it's something that you can say, hey, look, you signed this. You're at 10 days past. I don't know if you noticed, but per the contract, it's $50 a day. You're at $600 and that's continuing to grow. And at least it's just a little something that you're like, hey, come on, let's get this done. Because I've been surprised. Like I was a general contractor in Portland for a while and then out here. And I remember when I moved out here, people were like, you are the best, like, communicated, like, you're the contractor who talks to me, you walk me through stuff. And, like, I would go home and I'd be like, I'm a horrible contractor. I'm doing half of what I would, like, communicating-wise, like, hitting timelines. I would do half of what I did in Oregon, but in this particular market, that was still nine times better than any of the other GCs that were doing stuff in this market. So the bar is, like, super low. So we got to make sure as investors that we're, one, we're trying to identify good contractors to work with, but two, even when we get those contractors, we have a contract that then we could say, hey, this is what you agreed to. It's not just this conversation we had. This contract dictates how our relationship works and you agreed to it. So I think that's a great thing to bring up.
And in Idaho, you know, pretty much a contract has to be in writing. So it doesn't matter what they tell you on the phone. It doesn't matter. So as long as it's on paper, you can hold everybody accountable. So yeah, so that was basically like my last worst experience with flipping. But okay, so I say it's a bad experience. It was a bad experience with a contractor. I mean, it took 11 months to fix it, and then it sat on the market because it was like a higher dollar, you know, house. And it sat on the in its Twin Falls, you know. But it was a sweet house. It's been my favorite house I've done to date. It was like in the canyon, like down the road from the golf course in Twin Falls there. It's actually across the river, so it's the Jerome side. But it was just such a cool house, like custom built in 1970.
That's cool.
Yeah, it looked like this huge ship, and it had like a 700 square feet of deck on the back of it in the canyon.
That's so
it was
just, cool.
It was so cool. It was such an awesome house, and I still made money on it. If I were to pay myself for all the hours I put in, I was probably making like a dollar an hour, but
you learned a lot of lessons.
Exactly. And those are more valuable honestly than the profit. So, and ultimately too, like that was the first house that I actually had investors in. So that was, so this is where I get like, okay, so I had a lot of failure with contractors and like, you know, I wasn't able to, you know, flip, get up to 40. I was, you know, I've been doing this for, this is like my fifth year doing this. And so that was like my third and fourth years doing this. And I wasn't, you know, I was still doing like one or two houses at a time. So I was like, man, I'm just not getting anywhere using my own money. So that was the first house I actually brought on investors. So I kind of got, I still use a little bit of my own money, but pretty much it was investors' money. So that's kind of what opened the door to that. And then while I was actually had that flip going is when I found this six house subdivision, like just literally two blocks from where I live, that I started that process back in 2019 of buying it and doing the subdivision process, mm-hmm. which, you know, takes a little while, but that's all investors' money now. Literally I don't have my own money in any deal right now. So it's kind of cool. It was like, you know, that was kind of like the segue into, you know, private money, and, you know, realizing, okay, I need to do something differently because flips aren't working for me. Like I'm having a hard time finding a contract, and, you know, I'll still do flips, but I've learned a lot of lessons. And I have a lot of good subcontractors too, that have like done really well for me on flips. It's just I haven't found a general contractor.
Yeah.
And it's hard, you know, honestly, in this market, you guys probably know, like hiring a general contractor, sometimes a lot of times it's not, you know, you're going to lose money on a house. So,
So
I got into developing and doing new construction because I was like looking for opportunities and I wasn't necessarily seeing it on the market in flips and I didn't have the time to do my own marketing. So I found this deal on the market. It was overpriced actually. And I drove by it for 6 months. So it's like literally around the corner. I drive by it every day.
Yeah.
So like after 6 months, I'm like, oh, this house still on the market. So I just randomly one day, I went and looked at it again. Cause when it first came on the market, I looked at the price. I'm like, oh, that's overpriced.
Yeah.
Then 6 months later, still on the market. So I like just looked it up. I was curious if they had done any price reductions. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, so like I think originally they were asking like $750,000 for just the land. So it was a house and it sits on almost an acre. Mm. And they're asking $750,000 for just the land. And they were wanting it to only split off like 0.6 acres or something.
Jeez,
like that.
Louise.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, that's overpriced. Mm-hmm. So 6 months later, they had marked it down to, I want to say like $300,000 or $350,000 or something.
Oh, wow.
So it was a lot better. And I noticed that they were really like open to negotiating on price.
Yeah.
So I called up the listing agent and kind of asked her what the deal was. And she's like, well, you know, we've had a couple verbal offers, but we want something in writing. And she told me, I think one of the verbal offers was for $210,000.
Oh, wow.
Nice. And so I knew open up and tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Cause you probably would have offered the full asking.
Oh, no.
No? Okay.
Well, he's like, not full asking, but maybe not 210.
But it was a starting point. I was like, okay, so that's where their floor is so far. So anyway, so I came in and I think I offered actually like 215 or something in writing. And then, so they countered at 250 and that's when I was like, okay, I'm not sure it's going to work. Cause it was still like one of those things where, okay, 0.6 acres. And I wasn't really familiar at all with development. So I had no idea if I could build one house or six houses or what.
Yeah.
So I knew a little bit to look at the zoning code, you know, so I was like, you know, okay, I can build four houses maybe, but it kind of depends on the layout and like the lot requirements are a lot too. So like, mm-hmm. even though you can get the density, if the lot isn't set up that you can fit it with their requirements, you might only get three houses. So at the time I was like, okay, at 250,000, three lots doesn't make sense. Cause you still have to develop the lot. I was like, I can probably maybe make it work with four lots. And then I found out going through the process, I'm like, oh, I can build five houses. Nice. So then I was like, okay, I'm for sure can make money on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we went through that process of doing the lot split and the city denied it. Mm-hmm. So
denied the entire thing, the whole project.
Yeah. So they denied the lot split. So we were trying to do a minor land division. So the seller could keep her house and sell the land. Well, the city had a problem with that because it wasn't maximizing the density of the whole parcel. Mm. So they denied it because with the whole parcel, you can actually fit seven houses and we were only going to end up building six because she was keeping a big chunk of the land.
Yeah.
So they wanted to do a subdivision instead of a minor land division. So I went back to the seller and said, you know, and luckily I knew to set up the contract that it, because the city denied it, I wasn't out in earnest money or anything.
Yeah.
So when I went back to the seller, I basically said I had to cancel. Well, it was then her idea. She's like, well, I have an idea. What if I sell you my house as well, but then you build me a house as part of the deal? So it's basically trading her old house for a new house.
And yeah.
I'm like, at first I was like, I don't know if that's going to work.
Yeah.
Because that seems like I'm getting kind of the short end of the stick. But what happened is because that extra land was now part of the deal, so I got her lot for free. Mm. So it wasn't costing me anything for that lot. So that was just part of it. And then her house, ended up, you know, it's like 2,000 square feet and the house I was going to build was like 1,600. And my cost on building, you know, when I was thinking it out at the time, I was like, okay, $100 a square foot. So it was going to cost me $160,000 to build her house, mm-hmm. plus maybe an extra 10 to 15 to 20 for the lot development portion of hers. Yeah. But then her house at the time was worth like, you know, $270,000, I think. Wow. So it's kind of a win-win. So she was getting a brand new house that was worth more than what my build costs were.
Yeah.
And I was getting a house for that was worth more than what my build costs were.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a, it was a win-win. So it worked out. And she did seller financing on like 80% of it.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So that was kind of how I got into development. And that's, so I've been working on that project since the middle of 2019. I'm just getting building permits today.
Yeah. Hey, you got the building permits. So that's
So we did the lot development. That was done in January.
Yeah.
And then I got two building permits yesterday. Got another one this morning. Should have two more today or tomorrow.
What's cool about that, too, is you, I don't know if it was intentional or unintentional, but you rode the largest appreciation wave in Idaho and probably in the United States over the last, like, 2 years.
Yeah.
Like, we were 44% increase in Ada County. In Canyon County. I don't know where Ada County was. Canyon County, 44% increase last year. The year before that was probably some similar numbers in that 30 to 40% range as well.
Yeah.
So what did you think your new construction homes would be worth when you started, and what are they projected
to be? When I first analyzed them, I think I was looking at, like, $370,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now, I actually pre-sold them earlier this spring for $450,000 to $475,000.
Nice.
But they're all canceled now because basically the construction costs skyrocketed too.
Yeah.
And new comps came on the market that were like well over that. So like my comps right now are like $580,000 to $600,000.
Yeah.
So I went back to the buyers and I was like, you know, I got to make up. So, so they canceled, but like, you know, it is what it is, you know, like I wasn't going to eat the extra construction costs and I was, you know, willing to work with them, give them like a little bit of equity, but at the same time, it's like better for me, honestly, if I just,
You don't want to eat that. Pre-selling is such a fickle thing. We've done it. We've never been happy with it. Even on some of our flips, we've pre-sold them and the market's just gone so wild that we're like, oh man, we left 30K on the table right there. So And then the new builds, it's more of a normal thing, but I think when you're doing the small subdivisions, it's still just better to wait it out and get on market. Unless you're studying the trends and you see some sort of like the market's cooling off or whatever.
But right.
I don't, yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, like I went to be in pre-sold them, but like, so COVID hit beginning of last year, shutdowns happened, all these lenders stopped lending. And so I was like, I was ready to fund my like lot development. So I was like,
nobody's going to give you money though.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I found a lender. Eventually it took me like 2 months, but I found a lender. Mm-hmm. They're based out of Arizona and it was great at the time because they were like, we're still lending. Mm-hmm. Cost me like 2 extra percentage points. But they funded it. But their stipulation on the sale end of it was they were only going to let me build 2 houses at a time unless I pre-sold them all. And they just didn't understand the market, you know? So come March, I'm like, okay, I'm ready to build. And I thought I would have had building permits in March, by the way, but
yeah.
So March, I go to pre-sell them, and the only comps on the market for new construction were houses that had been pre-sold also, but they had pre-sold like 8 months prior and they were getting finished.
Yep.
So it was like that, you know, and this was, you know, 2020, which, you know, is where the market started to go crazy.
Yep.
So then, you know, I rechecked the comps in July just last month, and all of a sudden there's all these new construction houses that just sold and they're, you know, $600,000 houses. So now basically I'm sitting on, you know, five houses that we're going to sell. And then, the other one is a trade and they'll be left with the existing house.
Yep.
But that development alone has done really well. Like I was going to do okay on it in the first place, but like now it's like, it was good.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think the profit per new build is going to be?
So my costs on them, I'll have to redo them, but it's like probably $200,000 a house plus then the, you know, the existing house. So,
that's killer.
Yeah, that's amazing, dude. That's like a super fun project and like just the timing of it. You know,
yeah.
There's a little bit of luck that played into that, you know?
Yeah, so totally.
That's really cool. It's cool too. 'Cause the, the construction materials are starting to level off a little bit.
Like, yeah, the lumber is back down.
Yeah, if you would have built 3 months ago, your lumber would have been at its highest point in U.S. history, and now it's starting to come down. Roofing's coming down. Everything's starting to come down. So yeah. But and people
yeah,
are
almost benefiting. Yeah, multiple.
There's like this weird spurring going around, and maybe this will be the episode that does me in. But everyone's like, "Oh, the Boise market is depreciated out. Oh, it's we've doubled in houses on market." I'm like, yeah, we went from 0.4 months of inventory to 0.8. Like, we're still not even at a month of inventory when normal is 3 months. Like, we're nowhere near appreciating out. So you're still in this, you're in this spot where now the appreciation is continued. You've captured all this upside, and now you're ready to build, and the build costs are going down.
Yeah.
That's like everything's hitting, dude. That's awesome.
Yep.
What were some of your key takeaways on why the project took longer than you thought?
I mean, honestly, it's just working through all the government agencies. Mm-hmm. It's just so, you know, okay. So let me preface it with this. Like, whenever you call the city or some kind of agency, they're always great to talk to on the phone. Like, great people work there.
Yeah.
Like, they're awesome. They're super helpful. It's just, it's super, the processes are super inefficient. So, like, basically something that you think is going to take a month takes, like, 6. Mm-hmm. And then if you have any kind of issue, like, any kind of change, it's so much back and forth and, yep. like, talking to 100 different people and, you know, just, like, whenever you run into an issue, like, you know, as a business, it's our job to solve the problem, mm-hmm. right? And we get it done. Like, you know, we had an issue with our road in the subdivision, the lot development, right? So mm-hmm. that was, we paved in December. Which, you know, we paved in December, so that's really part of the reason why. So that was part of the reason is because it was cold out.
Yeah.
So we ran into some issues there. Well, we had a solution within 2 weeks with my contractor, and the city basically had like mm-hmm. verbally agreed to it and actually even via email. But then it took like 3 months for them to like all get on the same page and agree. So I'm like, how did something that took 2 weeks take 3 months to finally get resolved?
Yeah.
Like, even though everybody wild. Already. Yeah. So that took 3 months. Then it's like, you know, this is now March, and I'm like, now it's just getting the last signature on the plat. Well, that took like 4 weeks. Oh my goodness. So it's just, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I'm the inefficiency of government always surprises me, yeah. I guess, you know. So with it being my first development, I wasn't aware, because I'm thinking it from a business mindset. I'm like, yeah. Oh, this will take.
Yeah, you know. They're going to want to get it done. They want to make money for the city. No, yeah.
not them. They don't care about money.
Yeah.
So just they'll make their money up by dragging out all the additional permits and fees that you got to do.
Yeah, there's so much money in like doing a little subdivision. You know, these two we have, and I'm pretty excited. The minor land division one, I'm really excited about. The subdivision one, it has huge numbers, but like, I know it's going to be a pain in the butt. And like, I don't enjoy dealing with the city. So I'm like, man, the more I'm hearing this, I'm like, oh man, subdivisions. There's so much spread that it's like, yeah, of course we had to take it out and do it. But now it's like, I just hire on somebody to do all that, do that portion. But anyways, I'm our timekeeper. So we are coming to an end of the show, Zach. We appreciate you coming on and sharing some information with us. We always like to wrap up by asking, what kind of books or podcasts? Obviously, you talked about Rich Dad, Poor Dad. What other books did you read or podcasts did you listen to learn and get inspired to invest in real estate?
Yeah, so Robert Kiyosaki was like a huge thing for me. Like, I read, you know, he has probably 20 plus books out there, and I've read probably 15. So that was a big one. And then, you know, going to seminars, like go to all those free seminars. They're all, you know, designed to sell you sell you more, but like, it's, you get great information on those seminars. And then if you have the money, like, it's definitely worthwhile to pay for it. But at the same time, like, either all that information is out there for free. You just have to find it. Right. So like, I've never really been into podcasts or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to like get into it more, but you know, podcasts like this are great because you get all the information that I paid like, you know, $50,000 for over time. Like, you know, it's all free online and everything. So it's great for people. But yeah, just pretty much Robert Kiyosaki is most of the books I read. And I read other books too, like BR, the Burr Method book.
Yep.
That's really good. Although, you know, it's, anyway.
Yeah. like, depending on what market you're in.
Depending on what the market's doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of like rental property books, and I can't remember any like specific ones right now, but there's probably like three or four that I've read on rentals. So yeah, so just basically any, like, I go to Barnes & Noble like every couple months and pick up usually like, you know, some kind of personal development book and then a real estate book or something, you know, so.
That's rad, man. I liked what you said about the seminars. Like, they're going to try and upsell you, but also be aware that, like, some, depending on the ones, like, people are adding value. There's value there, so don't be scared to pay for a program or a coach or a mentor. Like, we never thought we'd spend a bunch of money, but, like, now at this point this year, we probably spent close to six figures on coaching programs, mentorships, and training. And, like, I have no regrets over it. Our business is going to grow because of it. So I love when people say that on the show. Like, don't be – What do you always say, Noah, that you're going to...
Oh, yeah. I say this on almost every episode. You're going to pay for your education in one of three ways. You're going to hire a coach.
Yep.
You're going to pay through your failures, or you're going to pay to be a part of some formal educational training program. Yeah. Right? But you always pay. It's just in which way do you want to
and
pay?
And normally paying through your failures is three times more expensive than for a seminar or a coach.
And a lot of successful people are going to tell you that they spend 5 to 10% of their income on coaches or mentorship or you know, personal development. So
yeah, our mentors have mentors who have mentors. Like that, it's just always, the name of the game.
It's funny because like we just got back from Maui Mastermind with some really, really high-level players, like the pinnacle people that you see as the forefront of real estate investing.
Yeah, that looked awesome,
right?
By the way.
It was super fun. But like every single one of them has a coach.
Yeah,
like when we learn that, we're like, you're like the as high as I feel like it gets. You have a coach? They're like, oh yeah, we all have coaches.
Yeah, and their coaches have coaches. Like it's wild. So yeah, I think that's key. Well, cool, man. Zach, thanks for jumping on.
Thanks for having me.
How can our listeners get a hold of you if they have any questions for you?
Yeah, just look me up on Instagram, that flippin', F-L-I-P-P-I-N guy. So just one G in there,
like that
flippin' guy.
Nice.
Yeah, look me up. Send me a message. Yeah, reach out.
Awesome, man. Cool. Appreciate it, brother.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, guys.
All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff.
Please subscribe to our YouTube channel in the show notes below. And if you ever want to get a hold of us, feel free to do it via our Instagrams. You can also follow us for our funny content on TikTok.